Welcome back to the program. It seems that every major cultural, social, and political movement of the modern era seems to be reflected in our popular culture at large, and is often centered in a particular place and time, and perhaps most of all, in the films that we watch. In the mid to late 1970s, the youthful freedom brought forth in the 60s was enshrined by a kind of golden age of a new independent Hollywood film industry. In the post-World War II period and into the 50s, the paranoia and anxiety of the Cold War was perhaps most notably reflected in our films as the divisions of the time were part and parcel of the industry that produced them. We're going to talk about this today with one of our country's most distinguished film critics. He is Jay Hoberman. He's the author of the previous book, The Dream Life. He's written for numerous publications, taught cinema history at Cooper Union, and has been for over 30 years a film critic for The Village Voice. It is my pleasure to welcome Jay Hoberman to the program to talk about his new work, An Army of Phantoms, American Movies and the Making of the Cold War. It's just out in paperback. Jay Hoberman, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here. In many ways, much of the films that Hollywood would make and much of the both praise and criticism of them in this kind of post-war period was, as you talk about, an outgrowth of how important Hollywood was to the war effort itself during the Second World War.
That's absolutely the case. And there's kind of a myth that movies, the movie industry thought of itself as providing escapist entertainment, and certainly that's true. But during World War II, the industry was functioning almost as an arm of the government, certainly in concert with the nation's war aims, working with the Office of War Information, and just about everybody was on board with that. I mean, it really, the producers and the studio heads really felt they were doing their patriotic chore during the war.
After the war, in Hollywood in general, there was kind of a fear and anxiety that had to do with, yes, the divisions in the country and the Cold War and some of the stuff we'll talk about, but there was also a general business anxiety. The consent decree had happened, television was coming on, there was political anxiety. It really filtered into every pore of the community.
Yeah, there was a tremendous crisis. I mean, the consent decree, which in effect forced the studios to divest themselves of their theaters, was a real blow. I mean, they had a very nice vertical monopoly going, and that was an issue. Television had been put on hold until after the war, and so they saw their audience eroding. 1946 was the peak year for movie spectatorship in America. And the fall off in the years that followed was quite dramatic. And then finally, they were under investigation by the House Un-American Activities Committee because of the primarily, or most obviously, because of the pro-Soviet movies that were produced during the war, but also because Hollywood was then as now, and maybe even more then, a very political place. There were a lot of political activists, a lot of left-wing writers and directors who wanted to make a certain kind of progressive film, exposés, social conditions, and so on. And there was a tremendous struggle within the industry itself over that.
And more than a struggle about any particular kind of attitude or politics or film, there was a movement away from, and this grows out of what we talked about before in terms of the war effort, there seemed to be a broader movement away from things that were just kind of a Manichaean clarity about black and white.
Well, I think that several things happened in the immediate aftermath of the war. There was a desire among the studios that came out of the congressional investigation to prove that they were still patriotic and were still, in effect, working with the government. And so you had a number of overtly anti-communist films, starting with The Iron Curtain in in 1948. And there actually was a struggle after Churchill used the phrase, the Iron Curtain. Two or three studios began fighting each other to secure that title for a movie even before they knew what the movie was going to be. So there was that desire, and at the same time, there still were a number of movies, Crossfire, Gentleman's Agreement, Home of the Brave, which dealt with social problems in the United States. And those movies also came under tremendous criticism, mainly from other political elements within the movie industry. Ayn Rand, the novelist and political theorist, economic theorist, was working in Hollywood in those days, and she wrote something called Screen Guide for Americans, which criticized a number of these movies, including It's a Wonderful Life, was seen as a movie that was mean to bankers.
And she didn't want to deify the common man. That was one of the other principles.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, there was a lot of kind of New Deal ideology that was enshrined in the movies. And, it dovetailed with certain other American attitudes about defending the underdog and recognizing a certain world of democratic possibility and so on. And that came under attack as well.
You begin by talking about a movie that kind of personified some of these things, a movie called The Next Voice You Hear.
Yes, The Next Voice You Hear, for me, is the quintessential Cold War movie. It's by no means a great movie, although it's quite interesting. And it deals with a number of anxieties that both political and geopolitical, although it doesn't really mention them specifically. Still, the premise of the movie, which is that for 6 days God gets on the radio, always when it's prime time in Los Angeles, and addresses the American people, is so cosmic. Although it's presented in a kind of weirdly matter-of-fact way, that it bespeaks a real fear, a terror of what's going to happen. And the movie did in fact open a few days after the Korean War broke out, which many people thought was the beginning of World War III. So it was a kind of apocalyptic movie that appeared at an apocalyptic moment.
And how was the movie received at the time?
Well, it came out of MGM, which was in some respects still the leading movie studio, and it opened in New York City at Radio City Music Hall, the most prestigious theater. So it was seen as a kind of event. It was treated not entirely respectfully. I mean, I think that the premise was off-putting to most critics. I mean, they felt that there was a kind of disconnect, that Hollywood was overreaching in a way to make this story. Although, as I say, the movie itself is very modest. It's almost like an unfunny situation comedy in a way. It revolves around a single family. The mother, by the way, is played by the future Nancy Reagan, which gives the movie another quality. But at the same time, they didn't dismiss it, and it was seen as a kind of interesting fantasy. It opened the same week as Destination Moon, which a number of weekly reviews, the two movies were bracketed together.
About 6 or 7 years later, Face in the Crowd would become the more commercial example of this in some ways.
Well, a Face in the Crowd, which came out in 57, after a period which I see as a kind of thaw in the Cold War, I think that, starting 55, 56, The hearings ended, at least so far as Hollywood was concerned. There was a certain relaxation. I mean, there's a kind of cultural ferment that begins to happen with Elvis Presley and the Beats and the Montgomery bus boycott, and the movies themselves become more adventurous, I feel. And A Face in the Crowd is kind of, I think it takes some of the same themes as the next voice you hear, mm-hmm. but in a more critical way. I mean, one way to look at the next voice you hear is that it doesn't really have to do with God so much as with the media. I mean, the idea that everybody is being comforted and instructed by the radio is, you know, you could see that as Hollywood, you know, almost talking about itself or its role. In The Face in the Crowd, a country singer, a pre-rock and roll star played by Andy Griffith, becomes a force, a demagogue in the country, giving political advice and swaying the opinions of millions of people, and of course also using the media. In this case, it's television as well as radio, and that's seen as a dangerous thing. So that it's a more critical view of the media, while still acknowledging its potential for influencing every aspect of American life.
It's interesting that so many of these movies in between that were allegorical in so many ways were either Westerns or science fiction films.
Absolutely. Well, you know, these genres have a historic basis. I mean, Westerns had existed since the very beginnings of American movies, and in fact, they came into existence as a kind of protectionist tendency, because before World War I, France was the world's largest manufacturer of films and dominated the American market, and Westerns were advanced as something that only Americans could make. So it was a kind of buy American form. But it really only came into its own as the dominant genre after World War II. And you know, for people like myself who grew up in the 50s, I mean, Westerns were every place, on morning TV, on primetime TV, in the movie theaters, and so on. I mean, it really was the way that the country kind of explained its own history, and so of course that became very crucial during the period of the Korean War and after. I mean, with cavalry Westerns creating a kind of an imaginative way to look at the war. Science fiction as a movie genre is also a product of the Cold War. I mean, there were very few science fiction films before that, and those that existed were sort of space operas like the Flash Gordon serials and so on. And I think that was a product of the change in human history that people recognized with the development of nuclear weapons, that this really was a drastic shift from anything that we had known before, that the next war could really be the end of civilization, and hence this interest in thinking, let's say, of us as not just people who lived in a specific country, but on a planet. You know, creating a kind of global sense, and you know, of us living in a really new and a perilous age.
And Invasion of the Body Snatchers is probably one of the prime examples of that.
Yeah, I think Invasion of the Body Snatchers is a great movie, and first of all, it really works as a genre film. I mean, it's still effective, you know, over 50 years after it was made, still a good thriller. But the allegory or the metaphor there is an extremely suggestive one. The idea that people are being, without their knowing it, taken over by some alien consciousness and kind of living, surrendering their personal freedom to live in a an emotionless state. And what's powerful about the movie is that it lends itself both to right-wing readings and left-wing readings. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it seems like a kind of obvious a metaphor for communism, godless communism, that these people become kind of drones who are all working together for some ill-defined collective good. But it also can be seen as a critique of conformism, which was a big theme in the mid-50s, and that's in fact how the filmmakers themselves saw it.
Right. I mean, it was a reaction as much to the man in the gray flannel suit as it was to communism.
That's right. That's right. And also to a reaction to anti-communism, to the kind of political conformity that was seen to be created by the McCarthy hearings.
It manages to do it also without too obvious a sense of irony within it, which is one of the kind of interesting things about it.
Yeah, well, I think that the guy who directed it, Don Siegel, was a terrific director of action films and genre films. And so there's tremendous conviction in this movie, and it moves right along. It's a very exciting film, and so it doesn't seem to be preaching at all.
Talk about the westerns of the period, things like Rio Grande, High Noon, and some of what they were trying to do.
Okay, well, as I said, the Western really came into its own during the Cold War period, and the kind of subgenre or tendency which best illustrates that is the cavalry Western, which is a combination of the Western and the war film. And the director who was most influential in developing that was John Ford, who was, in my mind, and I think for people in Hollywood in the late 40s, regarded as the great American director, in part because of his interest in American history. And so when he made the Fort Apache in 1948, he in effect revitalized or made the Western more contemporary by setting it on a cavalry base in the fort in the southwest in Apache territory, because you had a fully militarized society. You had an image of a mobilized society, which is at least partially how America experienced itself then, fighting this kind of implacable enemy, and defining itself as a nation in regard to this enemy. And so these cavalry westerns really lent themselves to exploring a Cold War situation. I mean, once the Korean War broke out, there was a veritable flood of them. And what's interesting in Ford's case is that Fort Apache is relatively speaking, a kind of liberal accommodationist film. There are good Indians and there are bad Indians, and Cochise is the reasonable Apache leader, and Geronimo is the dangerous one. But as the Cold War got more intense, Ford became himself more nationalist, more right wing in his filmmaking. So Rio Grande, which comes out in late 1950, early in the Korean War, in a way almost anticipated the war, with the cavalry longing to chase these Indians into Mexico, cross the border, which the government doesn't want them to do, and rescue these children who have been kidnapped. And it's just much more militarist than Fort Apache had been, and the genre, or at least this tendency of cavalry westerns, continued right through into the Vietnam War, during which some of them, thinking of a movie like Soldier Blue, were kind of anti-American, mm-hmm. or at least anti-Vietnam War cavalry westerns.
Another genre that was popular in the period and also reflected so much of the cultural ethos of the time were some of these biblical spectaculars that came along.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that they were, to some degree, these were Hollywood's response to the new situation. I mean, of having their audience being continually eroded by the popularity of television. And so, naturally, the studios would look for things that TV couldn't do. And so this is when you had suddenly these, you know, CinemaScope and Cinerama and 3D and a number of movie effects. And these spectaculars were an example of that. So these were things that you couldn't see on television. You needed to go to a movie theater to properly experience it. The money was also on the screen, so that was part of the spectacle. Another thing, I think, which probably wasn't as deliberate or calculated, but I think is certainly there, is that the United States emerged from World War II as the strongest nation on earth, and there was a sense that is burnished in a way, I think, by the development of nuclear weapons, but that America was itself a kind of equivalent to ancient Rome, or the heir to ancient Rome. And so I think there was an interest in seeing those times visualized. And it's been often pointed out that in these ancient world spectacles, they don't always take place in Rome, and they're not always sympathetic to the Roman Empire. Sometimes not, but that the rulers, the negative characters, are typically played by British actors, and the sympathetic characters, let's say the persecuted Christians or the dissident Romans, are played by American actors. So there's this odd subtext there of introducing aspects of the American Revolution.
What impact did The Blacklist have on the way some of these films evolved?
Well, you know, the most obvious thing is that there were a number of promising directors and writers who just lost their jobs. Their careers were ended. I mean, the most famous one is Abraham Polanski, who made the one extremely talented movie, Force of Evil, and then couldn't make another movie until the 1960s. But in a general sense, it was a fear of tackling controversial subjects, I think. Although that it must be said that the people did make movies that had critical content in them, but under tremendous stress. I mean, the most famous example of this is High Noon, which you mentioned, which was written and produced by Carl Foreman, who was a guy who had been a member of the Communist Party during the war, and so consequently had his name named during the hearings, and had to go to England. You know, his American career was over. But when he wrote the High Noon, he thought that he was writing an allegory about Hollywood. The idea that the townspeople are so cowardly, the marshal is left alone to face the criminals and so on. And there are even some things he put in there that refer very specifically to things that people had said to him. You know, they would, if they saw him coming, they would cross the street because that there was a lot of negative feeling about the movie within Hollywood, because people like John Wayne, who were super patriots and anti-communists, knew that Foreman had been named. So that ergo, the movie was a they saw it as a pernicious film and so on. But when it was released, people didn't really see it that way at all, and some people did give it an allegorical reading in the U.S. And Europe, but their sense of it was that it was really about America's position in the world, that the marshal played by Gary Cooper really was like personified the United States having to shoulder this lonely burden of policing the world, protecting it against communism, and so on. And in the years that followed, it became the favorite movie of American presidents, bar none. I mean, Bill Clinton actually screened it 20 times in the White House, but Eisenhower looked at it multiple times. George W. Bush bonded with the Japanese prime minister over their mutual love for High Noon and so on. So there's a way in which, to go back to your question, I mean, that yes, Hollywood was deeply affected by the blacklist on a personal level, especially, I mean, with people losing their jobs and so on. But a kind of struggle did go on in terms of movie content during this period, and as I said, during the thaw of the mid-50s, I feel that's when movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or A Face in the Crowd could be made. I mean, movies that were more complicated in their view of things.
And when did this period, as far as you're concerned, when did this period kind of come to an end, and what really marked it?
Well, I think that the, let's say, the height of the Cold War hysteria and the anti-communist crusade would have been around 1952. It would have been in the middle of the Korean War. The war was a stalemate, and I think with the election of Eisenhower in 1952 and his presidency starting the following year, that had a somewhat of a soothing effect, or it would. I mean, Stalin died in 1953 also. Joseph McCarthy, who was a kind of power unto himself as long as the Democrats had the presidency and the Congress, kind of went too far and even suggested that Eisenhower was unpatriotic, and that brought him down in 1954. So I would say that after that, you get a certain relaxation, and also America turned to it, had a new threat, no longer the communists, but the juvenile delinquents. And you had movies that were dealing with that.
And Rebel Without a Cause launches that.
Yeah, The Wild One with Marlon Brando. And there are congressional investigations into juvenile delinquency that are also bringing in Hollywood producers, and suggesting that they their movies were responsible for this, including the movies that we just mentioned.
Jay Hoberman, his book is An Army of Phantoms, American Movies and the Making of the Cold War. Jay Hoberman, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you. This was a great pleasure for me, too.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.